Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. And with us today is Professor Divya Charyan, the author of Merchants of Virtue, Hindus, Muslims, and Untouchables in 18th Century South Asia, published by University of California Press in 2023, and it's open access, and recently also published in India by Navayana. The book is winner of the American Institute of Indian Studies 2022 Joseph Elder Prize in the Indian Social Sciences. Professor Divya Charyan is an assistant professor in the Department of History at Princeton University. She's a historian of early modern and colonial South Asia with interests in social, cultural, and religious history, gender and sexuality, ethics and law, and the local and the everyday. Her research focuses on Western India, chiefly on the region that is today Rajasthan. Today, unlike the usual podcasts that I have, which are about books, we will be diving into the captivating world of the owl and the occult, popular politics and social liminality in early modern South Asia, published by the journal Comparative Studies in Society and History in 2023. Historians of Islamic occult sciences and post-Mongol Persianite kinship in the Ottoman, Safavid, and Mughal empires have recently made clear just how central this body of knowledge was to the exercise of imperial power. Alongside scholarship on Tantra has pointed to its diffuse persistence in the early modern period. But what dynamics beyond courts and elite initiates did these investments in occult science and Tantra unleash? Through a focus on the 17th century Mughal court and the Rajput polity of Marwar in the 18th century, this article weaves together the history of animals with that of harmful magic by non-courtly actors. It demonstrates the blended histories of Tantra, Islamicate occult sciences, and folk magic to argue that attributions of liminality encoded people, animal, and things with occult potential. For some, like the owl, this liminality could invite violence and death. And for others, like expert male practitioners, it could generate authority. By the 18th century, the deployment of practical magic towards harmful or disruptive ends was a political tool wielded not only by kings and elite adepts for state or lineage formation, but also by non-courtly subjects and quote-unquote low caste specialists in local social life. States and sovereigns responded to the popular use of harmful magic harshly, aiming to cut off non-courtly access to this resource. The early modern age was one of new ideologies of universal empires. The deployment of occult power outside the court was inconsistent with the ambitions of the kings of this time. Welcome, Divya, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your article.
Thank you for having me, Emma. This is a great honor.
The pleasure is mine. I really enjoy taking your seminar on early modern India, and in that seminar, I developed a paper which ended up being my dissertation project on the occult sciences and the Western Indian Ocean. So I'm really excited for the publication of this article and really wanted to share it with a wider audience because I think it can open up new conversations that bring in Islamic occult sciences, but also Indic Tantra traditions, which is not something that have been the focus of historians. So this is really interesting and groundbreaking research that I congratulate you on publishing. First, we would like to learn about the authors. I know you've given an interview about your book to New Books Network, but if you can say about how you came to be interested in the region of Rajasthan, being somebody from somewhere else in South Asia, what was it like for you to be on the verge of discovering a new culture, new language, and new traditions and archives in that region?
Great. Thanks, Emma. Then yes, I do remember very fondly that seminar. I remember your paper. I was actually super excited about it. I had a feeling I was heading in this direction in my research. So, you know, reading about this world of kind of an interface between nature, agriculture, and the occult, as you did in that paper, and, you know, as you're now doing for your dissertation, it was a really exciting thing for me to read as well. So I'm very keen to see how your work grows. In terms of my how it was, you know, getting to be familiar with a new region, absolutely. So my mother is from the very north of India. She grew up in Kashmir. She's Kashmiri. And my father is from Kerala, the deep south, who grew up in Bombay, speaking Marathi and Malayalam. And I grew up in Delhi, speaking Hindi, actually, for the first, you know, 8 or 9 years of my life, and surrounded by a lot of Kashmiri speakers. So I think when I never would have imagined that I would go to Rajasthan. You know, Rajasthan was an interesting place to me as kind of a tourist site, as one of those few places, at least in North India, where a lot of the built fabric of the cities is preserved from, you know, pre-colonial times in the old cities, which Delhi, unfortunately, did not have the good luck of having. That is, a lot of the pre-colonial Delhi was flattened by the British in the aftermath of 1857. But, you know, that's how Rajasthan was, just that for me. It was really the kinds of archives, perhaps not coincidentally, just like the architectural heritage was preserved and remained much more intact due to the particular trajectory of what became the princely states in colonial India. Perhaps for similar reasons, a lot of the archives are also quite well preserved. And it was the archival availability that drew me to Rajasthan. And after that, it was kind of, I would say, you know, a love-hate relationship, in that when I was a student, I was an avid hiker, actually. And so I thought when I do research, I will combine my love of the mountains with historical work. But, you know, those kinds of archives were simply, to my knowledge, not available. And my questions became about the history of caste and, you know, the interface with state power. I was not aware of those kinds of archives in the mountains. So then my next choice was the beach. So I thought maybe I'll go to Goa, but again, like, you know, that didn't pan out. So I was not thrilled to be in this desert town. And Bikaner is really on the arid side of Rajasthan. Bikaner is the headquarters of the Rajasthan State Archives. But I think, you know, just living there, and I really, it wasn't just an instrumental relationship with the region or with the archive, where I was kind of, you know, had cordoned off like that portion of my existence to like go into the archive and come out mechanically. I think I really enjoyed immersing in the culture of the region, you know, getting to know people of different generations and different social locations, getting to know the cuisine, I lived with students, women students in a women's dorm. So I think it was this kind of holistic relationship with Bikaner, where actually I have great memories, like, of my time in Bikaner, that I think, you know, made the experience one in which it wasn't kind of an onerous thing, like, oh, I have to learn this language. So I personally really recommend, like, you know, not just extracting, you know, archival materials from a region. I mean, sometimes you can't help it. I understand that due to personal constraints or political or other instability in the region under study. But if that's not a problem, I think it was genuinely an adventure. And also, this archive was so rich. I remember, so I talked to my mom like every day. So I would call every day and I'd be like, this is what I found today. And this is what I found today, you know? So it was so rewarding that it just kind of seamlessly happened that I learned this completely new language and script for my research.
Thank you for sharing that. I can definitely relate, because sometimes people assume that if you are from the region or the nation state, then you would be familiar with the rest of the country, which is not the case, especially in India. It's a vast territory with hundreds and hundreds of languages and cultures. So even for South Asianists, to be an expert on a certain region, it really speaks about long training and learning and immersing in the culture and the archives of that region. So thank you for sharing that. As the author of Merchants of Virtue, what drew you to to explore the early modern specifically. What aspects of this period intrigued you the most? And how did your research for the book intersect with your research and interest in the occult sciences?
I think, and I've said this elsewhere, I think first and foremost, it was growing up in Delhi, where a lot of, and here again, maybe I'm referring to that kind of built fabric from pre-colonial times. So a lot of that survives in Delhi, you know, and I grew up in a part of Delhi where there actually were a lot of like, not even well-preserved ruins. They were just kind of neglected, marked off ruins. And of course, there were other more well-preserved ones like the Qutub Minar that were not far. So I think growing up in Delhi, I was always attuned to India's pre-modern past. And then as I came to read about it in the classroom, it only opened up my interest more. Then I think probably it was maybe, you know, I grew up in India with intensifying Hindu-Muslim conflict, the rise of the Hindu right to unprecedented power. I think then again, like this time in India's past when Muslims ruled India and when, that same period was being demonized and kind of was being mobilized as one of the grounds on which sort of the harms of the Hindu right were being justified. I think that also perhaps, made me more curious about, well, what is this period that these people are representing as they are, you know, to the broader public. I think that perhaps also fueled my interest. And the third was that everybody seemed to gravitate towards modern South Asia. Among my friends and classmates who chose to do history at an advanced level and had to choose which period they would specialize in, most of them were drawn to modern South Asia. So maybe there was a slight like rebel in me where I was like, I don't want to do this time period. And some of that also went back to the curriculum at the undergraduate level, which was really very, very, at that time in Delhi University, about like the rise of the national movement. It was kind of like the history of the nation, you know, and there was a lot of economic history, questions of social history. Even though there was, of course, a wealth of research that existed, the curriculum did not highlight those. So I was like, oh, this period is just not that interesting to me. And so I, again, you know, was that drew me towards this kind of Mughal, what was then broadly understood as the Mughal and Delhi Sultanate periods of South Asian history. So I don't know if I think I answered your question. Yeah, those would be the factors.
Yes, listening to you and about your upbringing in Delhi reminded me of the book Genealogy. I don't know if you came across it, Time, yes, Islam, and Ecological Thought. Yeah, by Anand Taneja. Mm-hmm. I recommend the listeners to check it out if they are interested about how to live among Delhi's ruins and the occult as well. But before delving in the owl and the occult, what do we mean by the occult powers, sciences, and tantra in the South Asian context? And how can historians incorporate them in their historical studies?
So that is a very big question, and I don't even think there's obviously a simple answer, right? Like the occult is a term that comes, it's an English language term, right? It has a particular meaning in the West. So can we so simply, or even a term like magic, you know, can we very seamlessly apply those terms to non-Western contexts without, you know, critical work? Absolutely. I think there are a lot of things that might be lost in translation, but I have used the term mainly as a bridge to conversation about the occult. It is also a nod to the fact that sort of the Eurasian African worlds were deeply interconnected culturally with long roots of crisscrossing, cross-fertilization, right? So even though using an English language term may privilege the particular baggage that that term carries in the West, I do feel that there are ways in which different kinds of occult traditions were in a very long and slow conversation with each other across this world. So maybe it's also a nod to that. But what does it mean for South Asia? So I would say that, at least in the way that I've worked with it, I would say there might potentially be, you know, three nodes that build into this world that seeks to access and channel forces that are beyond the perception of the five senses, right? What we might call the supernatural. And there is in Arabic and in Persian, the term unseen does denote, which is also the literal meaning of occult or hidden. That same exact word is used to denote these types of forces. So I would say there are three traditions or three nodes that stood out to me, at least as I was doing the foundational work for this article. One is the kind of Islamicate sciences, the Islamicate occult sciences. The other would be the kind of overlapping world with Tantra. And that is an overlap that I would say goes into the medieval past. It's not a new overlap in the early modern period that this article is focused on. There's already conversations between Tantra practitioners and Islamicate science practitioners and experts in the medieval past. I would take Tantra as kind of a node for feeding into the kind of occult as it exists in South Asia. And the third, and this is the most perhaps undefined one, and where there perhaps is a lot more work to be done, is this idea of the folk occult, which is this recognition that not all the theorizations about occult practice and occult philosophies are coming from expert men who are trained in or initiates into lineages that are grounded in generations of textual learning, that there are practitioners and maybe also lineages or some kinds of communities of practitioners that are not a kind of a text-based, group that are much more, oral, that kind of slip through the net of the historian, because they have not generated their own body of textual materials left behind, but they have left traces. And here, I think it's Michael Ulrey's work that I'm really thinking of, but they have left traces in the textual accounts left behind by elite practitioners in the ways in which they incorporate or engage with those bodies of knowledge. So I would say these would be kind of the three nodes of the occult in South Asia. And in the case of perhaps Tantra, there's an added element compared to what I described about sort of the unseen realm, right? Which is, in the case of South Asia, Tantra traditions often push against or stand at a distance from, the Veda, for example. Like, there is this idea in Tantra traditions that through certain practices, certain exercises, and certain forms of discipline, and which generally also entail, a teacher, that you can, in a way, become God or godlike, right? And that is something that the mainstream Ramanical traditions would not ascribe to. And there's also, in certain kinds of tantric ritual, an intentional breaking of taboo. Like, things that are not permitted by the Brahminical tradition are in fact prescribed by the tantric tradition or certain streams within the tantric tradition. So in the case of Tantra, which I think perhaps is not the case with the Islamicate occult sciences, in the case of Tantra, there is kind of a tension with mainstream, what I'm calling right now, mainstream Brahminism. So there's a slight difference there.
Right. And in addition to that, you also have the Bon tradition, which is shamanistic, animistic traditions practiced in the Himalaya, which is also a binary with Buddhism. So it's fascinating how these, different practices intersect. When we read the early modern period and the three gunpowder empires, the Ottomans, the Safavids, and the Mughals, we read about the emergence of messianic and millenarian movements fostering occult sciences and their patronage at these courts. And in your article, you also argue that we should think of smaller polities and other political formations adjacent to these empires. Why do you think that's important to include in the historiography of the occult sciences and the early modern?
Well, And here, you know, it also goes back to the question you asked me about my kind of formation as a historian. I think I was always, and that might have also, you know, spoken to my kind of lack of interest in modern history as I initially encountered it, which is I was always curious about how do non-elite groups respond to, how do they participate in, how do they shape the historical processes that we study. Now, of course, this is a very common question, right? I mean, there's been this kind of impulse among historians for a long time. But yes, I just wanted to say that for me, that was always a question. So I think there could be a number of reasons why I think it is important to look beyond courts and look beyond the high imperial level, right? Like to shift attention to regional polities. So one would be simply kind of, where is the historiography leading us? And here I'm thinking of, for example, you know, in Asfar Moin's work or in Matthew Melvin Kushki's work, there is this reference to there being actually a popularization of the occult sciences in the early modern period, kind of alongside the uptake by Islamic imperial sovereigns in kind of channeling and sponsoring occult expertise within their court. But I think, again, as a result of the source material, that the scholarship has engaged largely, especially for the pre-modern, right, for the pre-19th century period, scholarship has been able to engage either with court activities, right, experts at court, the king's sponsorship of participation in refashioning as, you know, occult experts. So there's been that stream, or there's been the study of the kind of the technical materials of produced by, you know, occult scientists, shall we say. So it's been at that kind of high cultural production, right? And that, as I said, is a result of the limitations of the source materials, and is in itself, let me add, a historical breakthrough, right? For a long time, this aspect of early modern imperial formation had been neglected. So this in itself has been a breakthrough. However, as I said, one observation made by both these scholars, at least, if not others, is that there was simultaneously a popularization of the occult sciences. So how do we get at this, at that popular realm, became an important question to me. And also, I think it is just as it has been neglected, or it had been neglected at the high imperial level, this is an aspect of political life, social life, cultural life in everyday pre-modern South Asia that has similarly been neglected at the sub-imperial levels, at the regional levels. And again, you know, there have been others like Emma Flack's work on the Delhi Sultanate, on the Deccani Sultanates. It does pay attention to the occult. So again, at the regional level, also, it has happened, but even her work has focused on courtly production and courtly engagement. So my thrust has been, and here I will say that it was not something I planned to do, that I will make this breakthrough. My sources gave me access to an even, you could say, lower level in terms of, you know, structures of power of occult activity in pre-colonial South Asia, which was the level of, you know, non-courtly actors. So people who would still actually be relatively, some of them would still be relatively wealthy, but they were not involved with the even this regional court. So I think for me, it is an important and, well, shall we say, unseen aspect of South Asia's pre-modern past, going beyond expert practitioners and going beyond kings, that we simply must explore in order to get a fuller sense of the life worlds of people in the pre-colonial non-West and here South Asia.
Yes, indeed. And in addition to that, most of these histories were written based on these, courtly patronized sources like chronicles and poems or treatises and manuals, rather mm-hmm. than legal cases. So can you talk about the archival discovery of the legal case that you investigate in this article and narrate the history around? And how did you come across this case? And then how did you think about employing it in writing, let's say, micro history based on that case?
Mm-hmm. So some of this is, you know, the methodologies come from the kinds of archival materials one has found, right? So the micro history, if one could call it that, like I feel like my work, even my book, are kind of a tapestry of micro histories, you know, where I am kind of juggling, like the ideal micro history would be if I had a lot of information about a particular micro case. In the nature of the sources that I have this snippet of information about a micro case, and then it never comes up again, you know. But that snippet in itself, because precisely that it gives you insight into that micro realm that is so rare and difficult to find, I would say, is important, you know. And so for me, my work often entails a kind of weaving together of lots of micro cases, you know, micro histories. So it's almost micro histories, plural, that I do. So even in this article, there is a case that I lead with, because this is the case that I think that led me into this world. And this is a case in which I, you know, found that there is, I mean, what surprised me about the case is, and I'll just you know, lay out my sort of initial, what drew me into this particular question, is that there is a person who commissions an occult expert to use owl's meat to control someone's mind, to subjugate someone mentally or psychologically, right? And then when this reaches the state authorities in this kingdom, in 18th century Rajasthan, the kingdom of Marwar, they immediately get these two people arrested, beaten, and there is urgency to kind of make sure they are properly and fully punished. There should be no laxity. So to my mind, and maybe this was a very elementary question, that in a world in which everybody believes in the supernatural, right? This is not like some, you know, late 19th century, 20th century sort of science-minded state that says this is wrong because it is superstitious. That's clearly not what's going on here. So what is it that makes this magical act so egregious and immediately and urgently punishable by this state? So this was really what stood out to me. And as to how I came upon it, it was in the course of research for my first book, where my sources are not organized by theme or topic. So these were long, you know, running registers in which I had to go case by case. And that was also the nature of the very broad question that my first project asked, which is, you know, what is the history of caste in pre-colonial South Asia, was my sort of very broad question. So I literally was like, I have to look at every caste in every case. I'm including economy, politics, religion, everything in my frame, right? So I went case by case by case, and I would occasionally find things that I did not see a direct correlation with my work at that time. But I was like, okay, this is truly weird, and I must, you know, copy this down to keep for future reference. So the owl, this one stayed with me. I'm like, is it the use of the owl that is a problem? What is going on here? You know, and this was also, let me add, for anybody who might be familiar with my research in my first book, I thought it could be because there is an owl that has been killed. And this kingdom was in these same decades enforcing a ban on violence towards animals, which obviously also then included meat eating. So I was like, well, this owl was killed perhaps for this ritual, and that is the problem. So this was sort of the broad moment of, shall we say, archival discovery, as you framed it. But certainly the curiosity that was stirred in me by this case and these questions.
Right. And I really appreciate how you blended also history of animals and environmental history in writing about this case. Can you say more about the role of owls in ritual practices, particularly in Tantra, and the reasons behind their sacrificial use?
Yeah, so I sort of broke down this reference into like multiple possibilities, right? And so the owl emerged as an important one. And that is what kind of, you know, because I had, I think, at least one other source in which the meat of the owl is used for a ritual of mind control, also in 18th century Rajasthan. And there too, the state swings into action and makes sure that everybody involved is like suitably punished, and the punishment is quite harsh by the standard of the state. So again, I was like, you know, clearly there is something about the owl that is of significance over here. And that is when I looked into it and I realized that there is in Tantra, not only the owl, actually, there are many creatures that are associated with whose flesh, when combined with particular ritual incantations and other sort of tantric formulae, can unleash to the person who carries out the ritual, or perhaps the sponsor of the ritual, particular powers. And in Tantra, there is this idea of the six, you can say, let me just look it up. Okay, sorry. So six kind of harmful deeds. Okay, and this six is a notional number in the sense that it doesn't actually have to mean like which precise six are included, can vary. And in this case, one of those sort of six things is clearly always subjugation, and others include things like death or murder. And they're all, kinds of magic that are not what one perhaps in certain kinds of scholarship on Tantra associates much more with Tantra in its heyday, right? Which is kind of facilitating kings in having beneficial outcomes for the kingdom. So that is also a kind of sort of supernatural control that occult experts could command and could get sponsorship for. But then there's a much more like practical magic, right? Which is a term in Tantra scholarship, which is totally everyday magic applied to immediate ends, which can be harmful. And so the owl's meat shows up as a ritually useful product in those harmful kinds of magic, along with other kinds of ritual material. So one was that. Then the second was that I began to then find other places in which the owl shows up in as an important site of representation in pre-colonial South Asia. And for me, one very obvious place was this painting that was commissioned by Jahangir, which is called Jahangir Shoots Malik Ambar, painted by Abul Hassan around 1616, which is in the Chester Beattie Library in Dublin. It's quite a famous painting, right? In which there's been a lot written about it, because Malik Ambar, the person whose sort of severed head Jahangir is shooting with an arrow in this painting, Malik Ambar is also quite a fascinating historical figure. So between writing about Jahangir, writing about Malik Ambar, and then Mughal painting, a lot has been said about this painting. And the person who's really looked upon it from the perspective of what you just mentioned earlier, which is the patronage of the occult sciences by early modern Islamic kings, the person who's looked upon it from that perspective is Azfar Moin, who talks about how this was part of the kind of the what he calls sort of the millennial sovereignty that was first given form by Akbar for South Asia. And then, I mean, he traces a whole journey, right, from even before Akbar, but he shows how it was particularly manifested in painting in Jahangir's time. So I incorporate that painting as well, because there are owls featured in that painting sitting on Malik Ambar's impaled head, and one that has also been killed and is kind of impaled on the same spear as Malik Ambar. And there are little inscriptions in Persian on this painting. And so I build on Azfar Moin's analysis, as well as Yael Rice, whose new book on Mughal painting is out, to then say that we must pay attention to these verses, that alongside the painting, the verses are channeling occult energy, that it is not just a representation of kingship, but it is a talismanic object that is meant to wish upon, to kind of maybe even actualize for Malik Ambar, this kind of wish for death and destruction, that Jahangir hopes to see happened to him. So it was the Mughal painting as well, in which we see similarly a kind of, and then I traced how in Persianate poetry as well, the owl had a particular symbolism as being a bearer of ill luck and death and all of that. And I similarly find that in South Asian culture as well, there is this kind of negative association with the owl, which continues today, where there is this idea that if you sacrifice the owl on some particular nights leading up to Diwali, and I think also Holi, then you will find that things you wish for will come true. So this, I think, is something that continues into the present, this kind of association with the owl. So it's not just a distant, like, bad omen, like, oh, I saw an owl and that's bad luck, but you also want to control the flesh of the owl through ritual means today in South Asia. Not everyone, clearly, but in a country of 1.4 billion, even a small number of people who believe in this would not be too little. So people who still want to use the owl's flesh to see the realization of particular goals. So that exists today as well.
I hope these people watch Harry Potter to change their views of the owl and find it a cute animal.
That's a really interesting question, like the cutification of the owl. How did that happen? When did that happen, you know? Yeah.
Right. I'm fascinated by this concept of liminality, and you apply it not just to the owl, but also to the practitioners. How do you deploy this concept, and how is it useful to understand the status of these different actors?
So, yeah, I think when I began to think through what is going on here, because in the article then I trace that beginning with the owl, what I did was to bring together all the different references I had to this state. Punishing people for performing magic, or people approaching the state due to disputes that arose involving the use of magic, right? And I'm happy to explain what I mean, what terms are used for what I'm calling magic. So when I put these together, I noticed that there were essentially two kinds of actors, or you could say three kinds of actors, that were playing an important role. So one was the Jain monk. One was the Muslim weaver. It's a particular caste of weavers that in North India are known as Julahats, but in this region, it's a slight variation, is Julava. So Muslim weavers, Jain monks or yatis, and the owl. So these three types of actors seem to play an important role. And when I thought more and more about it, actually thinking out of the owl, what is it about the owl that perhaps caused humans to impart to it this special, like what I call occult fecundity, kind of a sort of a, kind of a thriving, vessel for occult power that can then be channeled. And really what stands out about the owl is the fact that it lives on the edge, right, between the seen and the unseen, right? The unseen being the occult. It lives on the edge. Why the edge? Because humans generally would spot it, being a nocturnal creature, at a time between night and day, whether it is dawn or dusk. And in fact, even in Jahangir's memoir, which is on, there's a particular day on the eve of a campaign upon the Deccan, he spots this owl at dusk. And there are other references as well. Similarly, owls are sometimes associated with ruins, places that used to be inhabited, but are today or at the time of whenever the source was composed, desolate. So these are spaces that kind of are between life and death. The owl is also perhaps liminally somewhere perceived as between human and non-human because of the nature, like the flat nature of its face, which resembles much more the face of a human. And also the kind of weird way in which it can turn its head to like sort of this unprecedented degree. So, and perhaps this is relevant for South Asia, but it also is a predatory bird, right? It eats flesh. So I think all of these qualities about the owl placed it in this kind of border space, right? What is the liminal? Neither here nor there. And so once I started thinking about the owl in that way, I came to realize that what perhaps also defines the weavers and the Jain monks who are similarly associated with occult expertise is a kind of liminality, with the monks being actually these Jain, particular kinds of Jain monks under discussion were actually on the border between fully initiated monks and lay people. They were also constantly circulating, moving around. So they were kind of outsiders to the community. And similarly, the Muslim weavers as well were on the margins of caste society. So they were not entirely, in some ways, untouchable. Like they were not the lowest of the low, but they were low caste, right? They were kind of lowly. But their occult expertise made them desirable among high caste practitioners, which are the kinds of cases I have where mercantile actors hire Muslim weavers to carry out particular kinds of magic for them. And there are a few cases of that kind that I was able to find. So I figured that there is something about being liminal, about being marginal, but neither fully out nor fully in, that perhaps is important in the attribution of magical power to beings. But it plays out differently for different such beings, where certain kinds of and this is where I introduce, social hierarchy, which is a running concern in my work, that if you are an elite male practitioner, that liminality becomes a source of power to you, even if you sometimes run up against the state. But if you are a Muslim weaver, if you are an owl, that can become the cause of social violence or physical violence for the owl, death. And where I plan to take this is that I'm also interested in ways in which women were accused of, magic or occult practice, and what forms of liminality then shape the experiences of women practitioners or women associated with the occult is where I think I see this going.
I was actually going to ask you about the gendered aspect of these practices. And I'm glad that you're following up on that. But since you're a historian, also an expert on the history of caste, how does it feature in terms of who's entitled to wield the occult powers? And why the courtly, subjects were really keen on preserving and monopolizing that?
So that brings us to this question of, well, why is this state punishing these practitioners, right? And that is where I felt that I couldn't see caste in a simple way right now playing a role, because the state was actually just as concerned with the Jain practitioners who were elite caste men, as it was with, in some ways, actually, the state was more concerned with the elite caste Jains than it was with the Muslim weavers. And it was not quite as, it would punish that magic, but not quite as urgently, not quite as harshly as it did the Jain experts' magic, right? And so I think that for me, the dynamic there, it's really about worldly power, where in a world in which everybody believes in, the efficacy of supernatural powers, this was a site of contention where perhaps the state took much more seriously the kinds of expertise the Jain practitioners had. And that is where I also trace out the differences between the kinds of magic the Muslim weavers are involved in and the kinds of magic the Jain experts are involved in, where the Muslim weavers seem to be involved much more with health-related matters, where if somebody has fallen ill, or you want someone to fall ill because you want bad things to happen to them, you hire the Muslim weaver. But if you want something like mind control, which is where I found, or other, the more tantric, like six acts kind of things that I talked about. And the six acts are, I would say some examples are utsadan, which is destruction, causing enmity, vidveshan, expulsion or uchatan, stambhan, causing paralysis, mahahanikaran, causing great ruin, and maran, or killing. Now, these are the kinds of six acts. If you want that kind of work done, you hire a Jain expert, right? So it seems that this body of knowledge was more concern to the state. And that is where I simply think the state wanted control over who got to, it wanted to be the force in society that could command and control these types of experts, is what I said. The other possibility, which I also explore and is perhaps related, is the rise of Krishna devotion, Vaishnav bhakti in this time period, which historically was kind of arose in contention with Tantra, right? Bhakti situated itself as being against or kind of counter anti-Tantra, a different path in which you would be kind of a servant to God. You would bow before God. You would not dare to do exercises that channel the powers of God into you. You might be able to do miraculous deeds, but that's because God blessed you, right? Because you were such a good devotee. So in that path, at both the discursive level as well as in terms of competition for patronage, there was a kind of rivalry with Tantra. So it is very possible, perhaps, that that is also playing a role in the kind of the more urgent attacks against Jain Tantra, where the state and the Vaishnav Jain merchants that man it are trying to weed out those forms of being Jain that perhaps are not as desirable as they used to be before the kind of ascent and dominance of the Vaishnava way of being. So those are kind of the two things I pull out as to why the state is stamping down magic, or at least magic by some people and not others.
Right. So magic becomes politicized and become one of the tools that not just the empires wield, but also the smaller, polities in South Asia are also invested in. Mm-hmm. That's very fascinating. Exactly.
And it's this kind of magic, like the harmful magic that is coming from Tantra, that rather than the things about making your neighbor sick, that seem to be more concerned to the state.
Right. This is very useful. I'm actually writing about hyenas, and I was wondering if you have seen hyenas in these cases as well.
No, but it would be, well, I don't think we have hyenas in South Asia, but it could be some other similar creature, a scavenger creature that maybe there could be.
Right. And they're also the practice of using hyenas is also gendered, and there are a lot of connections to be made with the owl. So this is very useful in my case, and I hope others will pick up this article and really enjoy the narrative flow and the clear writing, which is very useful to think about many questions related not only to what we have discussed in this podcast, but others. I wouldn't like to spoil and leave them as discoveries for the listeners to go and experience themselves. Who do you hope will read this article, and what sort of conversations would you like it to start?
So really, it just began as like a passion project, like one of those things you write because you build these references. So I was not very intentional as to which particular audience I would aim for, but I would perhaps some audiences that do come to mind I've tried to build some bridges with the literature on early modern Europe and the actually very similar regulation of non-courtly magic in Europe as well in this same time period. I hope for historians thinking comparatively in this same time period, it would be of interest. Hence, I the home for this article in Comparative Studies in Society and History, I hope, helps me reach that kind of audience. And then much more centrally, I was hoping, as I have done in the framing of the article, that historians of Persianate empires in the early modern period and kind of in the wake of the collapse of the larger empires or new kinds of developments in the 18th century in particular, before the European colonial conquest of large parts of Asia really took off, I hope that it would be of interest to them. Obviously, outside of South Asia, this might look very different. But I think that would be my other major audience. And the third would be historians of Jainism and of Tantra. I very much hope, obviously there are very, especially the study of both those fields is very, very technical, So for me, I feel almost intellectually I took a risk in kind of wading into that literature, to draw from it, to be in dialogue with it, and to speak to it, because as I said, it's a very technical literature. But I very much hope that for historians of those fields, again, Tantra, Jainism, that my perspective, which is from kind of a lived history of Tantra and of Jainism, that it might speak to them to then perhaps look back upon what they are seeing at the textual level in manuals and such like in the 18th century. So those would be, I think, the three. And of course, I should add, like I did wade into animal studies. And one thing that has perhaps dropped out is that I tried to think through what is it about, you know, non-human relations in this period that I can see in my materials. And there I feel like historians have been paying attention to relations that humans had with non-humans. But this has been in the form for South Asia of largely prestige animals, horses, elephants, you know, which is of course an important thing to study. But what about these other kinds of animals that were not companions, that were not prestige animals, and what particular kinds of work relationships did humans have with them? And so I very much hope that for that field, that is the human non-human relationships around the world, there's something here, a different kind of animal or non-human that I hope will be of interest.
Are we going to see more magical works in the future by you? Are you hoping to take this further and develop it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is the beginning and exploration for my next book project, in which I would say the running arc is the relationship between humans and the supernatural, and how sort of agglomerations of human power, such as the state, or you know, this construct called society, how does that interface with, how does it relate to this world of the supernatural, and how does that relationship with the supernatural in turn determine human relations of power, be they gender, be they caste, be they state forms. That is what I'm going to explore in my next book project, which takes me from the 18th century pre-colonial to the end of the 19th century, which is colonial, with a focus on the broad region of Western India. Right now, I'm interested in expanding beyond Marwar into the kingdom of Udaipur, which is a bit to the southeast, as well as to parts of Gujarat and Madhya Pradesh as well, kind of the southern tip of the Aravali. It's more like a fan of the Aravali Mountains, a kind of an ecological borderland. And I think I will in particular pull out the sort of caste, gender, tribe correlation, which really goes through massive transformation in that transition from pre-colonial to colonial. So I know all of this sounds abstract, but magic is very much the central thread, where I will also be unpacking what do English language terms like magic, witchcraft, and occult, how can we use them without erasing their particular social and conceptual histories in South Asia. So yes, this is the beginning of something new.
Sounds wonderful, and I'll be looking forward to the fruition of your project and having you again, hopefully, on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your beautiful article with the listeners. And thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Professor Divya Charyan's new article, The Owl and the Occult, Popular Politics and Social Liminality in Early Modern South Asia, published in Comparative Studies in Society and History in 2023. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.